This is CliffCentral.com.
And it's time to check in on the money this morning with Henry. Hey, we've never actually met. Look, he's in the studio, Mubs. Now we can see what Henry looks like. How are you, dude?
Fine and you,
Gareth. Nice to see you, man. Yeah, good. All right, so you're going to help us figure this stuff out. Apparently, Anthea is in Mozambique.
Oh.
Living it up.
Yeah. She works hard for her money, and then she plays hard.
With the money.
At spending that money.
Right. Yeah. Damn straight. Okay, so where can we begin, Henry? What do we need to know about this weekend in money? Obviously, not very much happens in terms of trading after Friday afternoon. But how did we look on Friday?
Right, well, I think if we just look at the week that's gone by, the All Share gave us 1%. The Resources Index gave us 1.5%. Industrials, similar at 1.6%.
But at this point, we'll take anything in the positive.
Absolutely. Financials were up 2.2%, and your consumer-facing businesses were down 2.7%. Mm-hmm. Turning to the major currency pairs, the Rand ended the week against the dollar at 13.98. Right. So that's actually stronger.
That's pretty good. Change. Would you be buying a couple of dollars, or is it not that good yet?
Well, I think we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but at these levels, I'd be comfortable too, for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The Rand ended at 17.10 to the pound. That was stronger by 2%. And it ended against the euro at 15.22, which is stronger by 3%. Turning to the major commodities, gold closed the week out at $1,265 an ounce. That's up by 1.2%. And oil was effectively flat at $52 a barrel.
Okay, well, that's a good price for oil. We should see quite a lot of interesting movements as a result of that. I mean, isn't 50 kind of like a benchmark? Usually when it gets around 50, then people start talking about, oil's cheap. Well, it's over 50, it's expensive, in most people's opinion.
Well, that certainly seems to be the sort of short-term base that the oil price has found.
It's like an imaginary line people have drawn, right?
Correct. Okay. And I think more important than the absolute price is actually stability in the oil price. And as long as stability continues, I think that's good for everyone, including the producers.
Okay, excellent. And of course, for countries like Saudi, it doesn't make a difference because they can produce it at like $10, $12 a barrel. They don't give a shit. You could put it up to 60, 70, 80. It's all profit for them. And if it goes to 30, 40, they're still okay.
That's true. That's true.
Huh. So they're really just toying with the rest of us.
In a way. Okay. In a way. But Gareth, really what I asked you if we could talk about this morning is investing offshore. You know.
And I didn't even have to give permission. You were just like, I'm going to do this. All right, so let's
hopefully you go for it.
Let's talk through this because I think for a lot of people this is something that they toy with all the time. And you always imagine that you have to be phenomenally wealthy to do some of this. And that's not true, right?
It's certainly not the case. You know, and I think investing offshore is certainly a daunting concept for most South African investors. Mm. And the reason for that is it's enough of a leap investing your money in the local stock exchange into businesses that you know.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of us think that we probably don't have enough money to even invest
to
offshore. We think that, I wouldn't qualify. I'm not a multimillionaire.
Well, you know, the point is, if you've got enough money to invest on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, you've certainly got enough money to invest on the New York Stock Exchange or the Shanghai Stock Exchange. You know, and I think really what it boils down to is fear of the unknown. Mm. But in reality, a South African investor who hasn't externalized money or who hasn't diversified their portfolio geographically mm-hmm. is actually taking more risk than an investor who has. And it seems counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So how are we taking more risk?
Oh, you've diversified. You've got eggs in different baskets rather than all eggs in one basket, right?
Correct.
So even if you've got a couple of different shares in the JSE, that doesn't entirely protect you because if the South African market goes through the floor, then you're going to suffer.
Correct. And my favorite way to explain it really is to ask, you know, if you were a Martian on Mars and you were looking to invest your life savings on planet Earth, mm-hmm. you would take a good hard look at this place and you certainly wouldn't bet it all on South Africa, notwithstanding what's going on here at the moment.
So think of yourself as a Martian on Mars, for God's sake. What's wrong with you?
I'm okay with that.
It's a good place to start. So, I mean, the South African economy represents around 1% of global GDP. That's a tiny, tiny fraction of the world's economy.
So which external stock markets do we want to be invested in?
So I would certainly look at the major two economies of the world. So that would be the United States, which represents about 25% of global GDP.
Okay.
And then China, which represents around 15% of global GDP.
Is it easy to invest in the Chinese stock market?
It certainly is. You know, I would say over the last 10 to 15 years, it's gotten a lot easier for a retail investor to invest in those markets. You know, all the major banks and all the major stockbrokers offer cost-effective platforms that you can access these markets through. You know, another thing that South African investors should certainly consider is the concentration risk that's present in our market. So, for example, on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, we have just 400 listed companies. Now, that's an incredibly minute number. I mean, by contrast, between the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, you've got over 4,000 listed companies.
Wow.
You know, additionally,
how many people are actually, if you had to take the total number of shareholders on the JSE, what is it, a couple of thousand people? It's not a lot of people.
I would say it's in the hundreds of thousands.
Oh, really?
Yeah. An individual company might have up to 5,000 shareholders.
On the JSE?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I thought it was much, much less.
No. But offshore, it's even more than that.
Okay.
And I mean, another interesting thing to take note of, actually, is that if you were to buy the index, or the all-share index, 30% of that index is made up by just three companies. So if you invested your life savings in the South African Stock Exchange, or at least if you bought the all-share index, 30% of your wealth would be invested in just three companies, namely Naspers, Richemont, and BHP Billiton.
Sure, not exactly safe.
No, yeah. It's an incredibly risky way to structure one's portfolio.
All right. Yeah. Well, there we go. So we've got to start thinking outside of the borders.
Absolutely.
All right, got you.
Another way to look at it would be to look back 10 years and to see what the relative returns would have been had you invested in South Africa or in the United States.
Yes, love doing that.
So the way we
have... the money that you could have had if you were smart.
Yeah.
So over 10 years on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, you would have made 100%, and that sounds good, right? But when you rebase that into U.S. dollars, which is really the true measure of your wealth, isn't it? I mean, we all should look at ourselves as dollar investors, not rand investors.
Okay.
You've actually only made 3% in 10 years.
Yeah. That's terrible.
That puts a different spin on it, doesn't it?
That doesn't even beat inflation.
Well, it doesn't, of course.
That's half of inflation.
Exactly.
At best.
Exactly. I mean, U.S. dollar inflation is running at about 2% a year. So, in fact, over 10 years in U.S. dollars, you've actually gotten poorer.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, that's depressing.
Extremely. And by contrast, if you'd invested money on the S&P 500, you'd be up 50% in dollars.
Oh, that's a big difference.
That's a massive difference, isn't it?
Sure, all right.
So we think you need to think of yourself as a U.S. dollar investor, and certainly, you know, we would advocate at least sort of 40 to 50% of your portfolio being invested offshore. You know, and the volatility of our currency, again, is something else to consider, and it's another reason to externalize a portion of your life savings. I mean, since November last year, the rand has moved by over 5% to the dollar every single month on average. Isn't that unbelievable?
Wow, okay.
And to put that into contrast, you would expect the rand to depreciate by about 5% of the dollar on average every year, because that's the differential between American inflation and South African inflation. It's 5%. So basically, we're experiencing annual scale movements in the currency almost on a monthly basis.
Unbelievable. These are pretty mind-boggling figures that you're giving us this morning. I'm starting to feel like I'm in very precarious ground.
Yeah, and the information is there for us to see every day, but often we don't zoom out and take a look at the bigger picture.
Well, that's why we bring you in here. Let's not mess around.
Happy to help.
All right, let's just talk quickly about the value of some of these picks in particular, right? Let's look at PayPal and Home Depot and Disney, for example.
Yeah, so I mean, let's start off with Home Depot. So I mean, these three stocks are essentially businesses that we've taken a look at over the last month.
Home Depot is like the U.S. version of Builder's Warehouse.
Correct.
Right.
It's a very good illustration. Yes. They're just much, much bigger. They've got about 2,000 stores across the states.
Right.
And, you know, the American housing economy now is coming out of a six-year-long recovery, and I think Americans are starting to think of their houses as investments again rather than expenses, and that's a good thing because it means they're going to start spending money on their houses again.
Uh-huh.
You know, house price inflation is now running at about 5% per annum. Home Depot believe that they've still got a lot of runway for growth, so they think that at this point they've only got about a 15% market share in the States. And what I like about them in particular is that they're sort of pioneering your DIY e-commerce industry, well, the DIY e-commerce market, where they can offer sort of next day delivery of things like wood and gypsum board, and these aren't typically things that you can order online.
My buddy buys a lot of gypsum board, so let's not...
How did you know?
I've seen that sometimes you leave the invoices on the printer. Jeez, I've never seen anyone who's not building a house buy so much gypsum board. I wonder what the hell's going on there. All right.
Damn.
Well, Home Depot can help you out there. PayPal is one of the more exciting ones, and I think it was founded by our fellow South African
Elon Musk. Yeah,
exactly. And really, that business's mission is to replace cash and to replace our wallets and our credit cards.
Okay.
And really, it allows one to pay for anything, whether it be online or in a store, simply at the touch of a smartphone or at the touch of a button. In the case of online. They've recently concluded partnerships with Visa and MasterCard, so they're not trying to displace those brands. They're trying to work with them to make it easier to pay with those facilities. And they're processing around $350 billion in transactions annually, and that's growing at about 30% per annum.
Okay.
They've got about 200 million users globally and about 15 million merchants that accept the method of payment. So we really like PayPal. It's given you around 20% over the last year, and we would expect a similar return.
Yeah, I use PayPal. I use them for a lot of the stuff that I buy, you know, in terms of eBay or overseas merchandise, you know.
Well, it makes it incredibly easy, doesn't it?
It's great.
And one of the things we love about it is their one-touch payment method. Right. So you don't have to put your username and password in.
Correct.
Anymore. You find what you like and you click buy.
Exactly.
It almost makes it too easy, doesn't it?
You want that to be easy. Otherwise, because people are nervous about spending money, even now. Like, I still bump into people who say to me, oh, I don't know if I want to put my credit card details in online. And I say to them, you're missing out on a world. Why would you only go to one shop? It's the same reason you say, for example, we should be diversified in terms of international money. We shouldn't only have our money on the JSE. I say to people, why would you want to go to the same stupid corner store your whole life long when there are amazing retailers all over the world that you can get incredible products? You don't have to travel to America to buy American stuff or Chinese stuff or anything else. You can get it all online.
Correct.
It's great. It's the best marketplace in the world. Get on there and get yourself a PayPal account, you idiot.
The third business that we like is one that I think we sort of all familiar with, and that's Disney.
That's right. My buddy's favorite company.
And we're all familiar with their theme parks, and we're all familiar with their very successful movie franchises.
Yes.
But one thing that I don't think is widely known by retail investors is that their biggest operation is, in fact, the ESPN Sports Network.
Oh, yeah?
Oh.
Is that really their biggest?
It really is. It accounts for about a quarter of their operating profits.
Sure.
Now, if you've been watching the Disney share price, you would have seen that it's come off somewhat. It peaked at around $115, and it's now at around $90. And the reason for that is that there's growing concern among investors around how people consume television content.
Oh, yeah. And I know where this is going.
I think you do.
Yeah. Nobody really cares about what's on TV networks anymore. No one pays any attention to that. They want to get what they want when they want it on demand.
Correct. So you've got people who are frustrated and they're tired of paying $60 to $70 for an extremely expensive cable TV package, and 80% of the channels are actually channels they aren't interested in. They'd much rather switch over to something like Netflix or Amazon Prime, where at $11 or $12 a month, you can choose what you want to watch when you want to watch it.
Definitely. It's the end of satellite television and cable in America.
I believe so.
Sure.
So the net effect of that on ESPN has been shrinkage in their subscriber base. Mm-hmm. So that peaked at around 90 million subscribers, and that's actually fallen to 80 million subscribers. And that's a trend that looks like it might continue.
Ben, you like ESPN, right? You get a whole bunch of stuff on there that you don't get anywhere else.
Yeah, it's a huge network. It really is. And we look at numbers and what they spend on staff and all those kind of things. There's this great site called Business Insider, and the sport of that, always having these great infographics of what ESPN is and the rest of the industry. It's like,
well, also sports,
light years ahead.
And Henry, you'll agree with me on this one, I'm sure. Sports is also one of those things that you're just never going to be able to do as a download. You need to watch that stuff live. No one wants to watch a sports match 3 days later.
Exactly.
Precisely.
Right.
So I've told you why people don't like Disney, but I'll tell you why we do like it.
Mm-hmm.
And that addresses this question now. So Disney have made an interesting acquisition. It's a business called BAMTech. Now, what BAMTech is it's Major League Baseball's online streaming service.
Yeah.
So think of it as the Netflix of baseball.
Okay.
And Disney has a plan to turn BAMTech into ESPN streaming.
Hmm.
Okay, and that's going to go live by December this year.
Hmm.
All right.
So we think it's going to do very well, and we think that once that business starts reporting subscriber growth, you'll see a lot of faith return to the share, and we believe that it's worth closer to $115 to $120, which obviously represents a reasonable return from $90.
Okay, very, very good. Well, is there anything else you want to throw in?
No, I think that about covers it.
Okay, you've given us plenty to chew on. Thanks, man.
Pleasure.
Cool. Henry Bilcombe is here from Anthea's Partners. You're at Anchor, right?
Correct.
Yeah. All right, Anchor Capital, and thank you for coming in to share these insights with us, telling us about what we should be invested in and giving us every reason to pay careful attention to these moves up and down, because it could mean the difference for us between ending up 10 years from now 3% bigger than you are, which is ridiculous, or 50%. I mean, at least maybe even more than that. Come on, give us those 1,000% returns that we hear about. Tell us how to do that. Anthea will be back tomorrow. Thank you very much, Henry.
This is CliffCentral.com.